Charlie. Good morning, everybody. Today's topic we'll take up is the breastplate and the God's name that was embedded inside. Start in about a minute or two. We are referring to different areas in the Chumash, primarily when the law was given. And to Tetzaveh, the clothing of the high priest, because that's where the breastplate was included, the 8 garments of the high priest, and also when it was employed in terms of when Moses was going to pass away, so God informed him, because Moses had prayed that God not leave the people like a shepherdless flock. So he told Moses that he was going to place Yeshua in this place, and also that Elazar would take the place of Aaron, and he would be the priest, and the people would consult with the Urim and Thummim, the names of God, in the breastplate. We'll go through it. We'll start in about a minute. Jennifer, Jackie, Mike, thanks for the audio confirmation. JHS, thank you. And just as to make it easier regarding the question and answer, it's better off if there's if you hold off on the chat, so this way I don't get confused in terms of what entries I have to look at for your questions. Okay. Good morning, Doug. Good morning, Cal. How are you?
Good morning, Rabbi. Sean Bone, too.
Okay, Sean, how are you?
Good, thank you. Good. Can I ask a fast Hebrew question before we get started?
Sure.
The word Isurim.
Wait, Isurim means prohibitions. The root is...
Prohibitions.
Prohibitions.
So the context of my question is that I was listening to Rabbi Chait Shiram talking about prayer, and if I understood him right, what he said was that God will give a person Isurim, but then if he gets angry, he won't give it to him.
No, that's a different word. That's Yisurim.
Oh, Yisurim.
Yisurim refers to pains or troubles.
Oh, okay. That's what I was thinking in terms of context, but I want to make sure I was understanding it right.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So today I wanted to take up, as we mentioned last week, the breastplate, one of the 8 garments of the high priest. Actually, he only deviated from the typical priest with 4 garments, because both the high priest and the regular priests in the temple would wear the pants, the shirt, the hat, and the belt. But the priest had a few more. And one of them we're taking up was the breastplate, which was a plate on his chest that was the width, I think, open hand, I think from pinky to thumb, if you have your hand open. Zeris is the measurement. So it'd be about, I'd say, 10 inches or so wide, 10 inches tall. But it was doubled, so it was actually 20 inches tall, 10 inches wide. And they'd fold it in the middle, and inside of it, it contained God's names. I'm not sure if they were written on parchment or inscribed in gold. That I didn't find information on. But nonetheless, God's names were inside. And on the external of the breastplate were 4 horizontal rows of the tribes, and each row had three names that gives you the 12 tribes. And each tribe was engraved the name, like Reuben and Shimon and Levi and Judah. They were inscribed in Hebrew on the stone. But this was not the only place that you had the 12 names of the tribes. You also had the 12 names of the tribes written six and six on two onyx stones that were on the shoulders of the apron. And they were fixed, I think, in gold settings. And from the settings, so there were two gold chains that went down from the right shoulder, one from the left shoulder, and they connected to this breastplate and suspended the breastplate. It's a very unique type of structure, as anything in Torah. The specifics of it raise the questions, but also are indicators as to what the purpose of it is. You know, it's interesting that the I'm going to read a Ramban in English just to get some background on it, and also to highlight some interesting ideas regarding this breastplate. Let me start with that. And in Numbers, chapter 27, verse 21. So there's a certain point where God is telling Moses at the end of his life that you will go onto the mountain and you will see Israel, but you won't enter it. And that, of course, was a punishment because he and Aaron had failed to sanctify God's name, and they hit the rock instead of just speaking to it. So because of that, the flaw in leadership, so then his leadership was terminated prior to entrance to Israel. And God is saying this to Moses. So Moses says, it is in chapter 27, verse 17. So 27:17, Moses is asking that God should give the people somebody that would go before them. If he's not going to die, they shouldn't be like a shepherdless flock that has no shepherd. They shouldn't be like sheep that has no shepherd, he says. So God says back to Moses in 27 verse 18 that he's going to place of the glory of Moses on Joshua. He will be to replace him, and he will stand him before Eleazar the Kohen and before the congregation. So Eleazar was Aaron's son, who replaced his father, and Yeshua is now going to replace Moses. And in 21 it says, and before Eleazar the Kohen, Yahmod, he will stand and he will inquire in the Mishpat, the judgment of the Urim. The Urim Batumim is now what the name was given to these the title, I should say, it was the title given to the names of God that were inserted in the breastplate. So the breastplate had sort of a bag, which we'll read shortly in the Ramban, in Nachmanides. And in it was placed God's names, different names. And Joshua, or the leaders, or like King David did, they would inquire of the priest who was wearing this breastplate that had God's names, and they would ask about it. And what was it they would ask? So Rashi states, when they would need to go out to war, they would inquire from the Kohen, and the Kohen would ponder God's names, and he would receive a prophetic answer as to what they should do, who should go first to battle, different questions they had. But it seems to be regarding going out to war, as Rashi says, and that's Rashi on 27:21 in Numbers. So, you know, you have to go to different areas in order to pick up information as to what the various hints are as to what's going on here with this breastplate, and what was this type of phenomenon. I mean, there were many garments that the Kohen wore, that the priest wore. He wore eight different garments. So the breastplate is singled out. Why? What is this concept? And what's the idea about having two sets of the names of the 12 tribes? On the shoulders, there were black stones, six on this and six on that. And on the breastplate, there were, again, the 12 names. now written individual stones on colored stones. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
The names of God that were inside the breastplate, were those engraved, woven on the cloth? Were they written on something that rested in there?
I do not know. I was trying to find that out. It didn't seem to say, and Ramban actually makes a point, an interesting point, that he says that of all the different, you know, articles that we have in the vessels of the temple and then the priestly garments, you have specifications, the parameters of their structure, but you do not have any type of specifications for the parameters of these names. He makes a point of that. He's trying to indicate something.
Interesting.
Yeah. We're going to read that in a second. I just want to make sure we cover these verses here, that we see that the Torah says openly that when Moses is about to die, so God answers Moses' proper question that the people shouldn't be left as a shepherdless flock. So he guarantees that Joshua will take Moses' place, and he will inquire of the breastplate, the Urim and Tumim, meaning the names of God were referred to as Urim and Tumim. So the words in Hebrew mean, Urim means light, and Tumim means to make perfect. So we'll read the Ramban, what exactly that means. He says that when the question was inquired about the war, so then he would contemplate God's names, and then various letters would light up on this breastplate. And then he would, that's what Urim means, they would light up, or from the word or, light. So Urim, they would light up. And Tumim means that even though they were lit up, the Kohen, the priest, still had to figure out what he had to unjumble, so to speak, the order of the letters to create a comprehensive communication. And then he would, so that's what Tumim meant. Tumim means make perfect. It made perfect the Kohen's, the priest's interpretation. So that's why the names of God are referred to as Urim v'Tumim. They make light, meaning they lit up the letters, and they make perfect. They clarify the interpretation of the Kohen so he can communicate to the king, to the leader, what the response would be from God. But it is a very funny, it's sort of like a Morse code. It's a very interesting, intriguing type of a design of communication. And what is this for? Why is this needed? The question is just to keep on adding on to the intrigue. And also, the verse says in 27:21 in Numbers, and God is telling Moses during his conversation when Moses pleads for there to be a leader. So God says, and how it will work is that the leader will stand before Eleazar, meaning Joshua, and he will inquire of the mishpat of the Urim. He'll inquire of the judgment of this type of a codified prophecy. What does it mean, the judgment? The word mishpat means judgment. So what is it's stressing? This concept of a judgment is now given out. That's what the Kohen, the priest, would perceive in this type of prophetic type of communication. And then Joshua would then receive the judgment. As in general, too, a very main question is this concept of there being a king of the Jewish people and also there being a high priest. Interesting, right? I mean, what is this dual type of a leadership? If you'll take a look now at another point that discusses this.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Where's the part about the reference to the king?
I'm going to read it now.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm not saying there's a reference here. I'm just saying that's a fact. There's a fact that there was a king, meaning Joshua. Joshua's not taking over the role of the leader of the people. But that was not enough. There also had to be the high priest. So I'm just saying, you see, there were two institutions.
Oh, I see.
Why not just have one?
Yeah.
All right? So if you take a look in Deuteronomy, chapter 20, I think is where it starts. Yeah. Deuteronomy 20 talks about, and it says, when you go out to war on your enemy, and you see the horse and the chariots, a great many people, a great multitude, greater than you, don't be afraid from them, because God, your God, is with you, that took you out of Mitzrayim, he took you out of Egypt. And when you come, when you draw close to battle, the priest will speak to the people. And he will say to you, listen, Israel, you are coming close today to battle on your enemy. Let your hearts not be faint, and don't be afraid, and don't tremble, and don't have any worries regarding them. Don't fear from them. Because God, your God, had went before you to battle for you in your enemies. Because it is God that is going before you to battle with your enemies, to save you. Then it says, the police officers would speak to the people and say, whoever built a new house should go back and not go into a war. Whoever had engaged in a woman, whoever planted a vineyard, go back, turn back. So in terms of practical issues, then the policemen would come in, but the priest would make this one introductory statement. All right? So it's not the king that does it. So interesting how the Torah designates this, and he is now there. This is a separate priest, not the high priest, but he wore, the Talmud says, that this one who was anointed for war, the priest that was anointed for war, wore the same 8 garments as the high priest. Which is also significant. But the statement that he makes is not that they should not be afraid, and they should be, they should know that God is going before them. Okay, and this is specifically a law that the priest must make this address to the people upon their initiation of battle. Okay, and we see that King David had inquired of this Urim and Tumim of the breastplate of God's names. He had inquired, and he received responses, and on other occasions as well. Okay. And again, just to stress the question, you don't see that these names of God were inserted in any other garment of the 8 garments. Like he had a gold plate on his head, the high priest, which read the words, holy to God. Okay.
Can I ask, and I don't want to get us off on our side, this is something we should cover later, but in the part you just read, so the Kohen stands up and says, don't be afraid, because God's going to fight for you. Then it goes on and gives several categories of people who get excused. And then finally sums up with, if anybody's fearful.
Right, because they want to make sure practically that nobody incites a panic. So they first try to let people leave by saving face and saying if you engage a wife or whatever, so people can go under that guise, even if they didn't, because it would allow the other people who are looking to feel secure why people are leaving the straits of battle. Because there's a good reason. They made a house, and they have a wife. There's other, they're very big concerns. So this is something which people would accept, why certain people would back off from war. So it gave them, I think Rashi, I'm not sure who talks about it, but it gave them cover, so it wouldn't be embarrassment. But finally, in case these people, you know, in case somebody was afraid, but he didn't respond, then he took the priest literally and says, I can only leave if I have a wife, or if I have a planted a vineyard, or if I built a house. But I didn't have any of those 3 excuses, so I have to stay, but he was still afraid. So eventually the priest would then finally say, and if anybody's afraid, then go. So the least amount of embarrassment would occur.
I got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. So now let's take a look at the Ramban, all right? Let's read through. And this is the Ramban. It's in Exodus, it's 28:30. I'll read it in English. Okay. And if you have any questions as we're going through the Ramban, so just, you know, take a pen and paper, just jot it down. And we'll go back. Okay, so this is where the actual instruction, the first time in the Torah, is recorded to actually create the breastplate and to place inside of it the judgment. Again, it says the judgment of the Urim and Tumim. And now I quote Ramban. Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra thought to display wisdom in the matter of the Urim and Thummim by saying that they were made by a craftsman from gold and silver. And he continued his discussion of them in this vein, for he thought that they were akin to the forms which the astrologers make in order to know the thoughts of the one who comes to ask of them about the future. But what Ibn Ezra said is of no importance. Rather, and this is Ramban speaking, his own view, he says, the Urim and the Tumim, again, that refers, I'm just telling you parenthetically, that God's names, right? So he says again, rather the Urim and Tumim are as Rashi has written, quote, this was an inscription of the proper name of God, which was placed between the folds of the breastplate. So he says it was one name of God. It was for this reason that the breastplate had to be double, i.e., made of a material that was folded in order to form sort of a bag into which the Urim and Tumim, the sacred names of God, as explained further on, were placed by Moses. Now he refers to it as a few names. Okay. The proof of this is that in the work of the craftsman, the Urim and the Tumim are not mentioned at all, neither in the command nor in the description of making thereof. Meaning the Torah talks about the commands of making the vessels and the priests going, and then it actually describes when they actually constructed it. So Ramban here is saying, in neither case do you have any type of parameters mentioned in the Torah, right? Neither in the command or in the description of the creation thereof. Now, concerning the garments, I mean the priest's garments, he details, quote, and he made the ephod, and he made the breastplate. But it does not say, and he made the Urim and Thummim. So Ramban is proving that it was not a construction. Further on, the Ramban continues, quote, and if it were the work of skilled engraver, he would have dealt with it in greater length than with all the garments, even if perhaps he desired to shorten the discussion about them on account of their profundity, he would at least have said, quote, and thou shalt make the Urim and the Tumim as it has been showed to you on the mountain of pure gold, of purified silver, you shall make them. End quote. Moreover, you will notice that he did not use the definite article, meaning the, right, in connection with any of the vessels of the tabernacle, which had not been previously mentioned. Instead, when God said, quote, and they shall make an ark, and you shall make a table, thou shalt make a menorah, and also in connection with all of them, it says it this way. There's no definite article used. In the case of the tabernacle, however, he said, and you shall make the tabernacle, because he had already mentioned it in saying, and let them make me a sanctuary. So the word the only refers to something which is previously noted. I can't tell you to get into the car. Well, which car am I talking about? I haven't referred to any car yet. So he says, but since the tabernacle was previously referred to in the Torah, so God can tell Moses that they should make the tabernacle. Fine, but there was never discussion about the candelabrum, about the ark, about the table of showbread yet. So when God first introduces it, he tells Moses, make a ark, make a table, and so on. Now I'm going back to the Ramban. Quote, now with reference to the Urim and Tumim, God said, quote, and thou shalt put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Tumim. He did not command him as to the making of it yet, and yet Scripture mentions them with the definite article, using the word the. Moreover, Scripture mentions them with reference to Moses only, saying by way of command, quote, and thou shalt put in the breastplate of judgment, and so on. Similarly, at the time of making them, it says, and in the breastplate he put the Urim and the Tumim. Since they were not the work of craftsmen, neither craftsmen nor the congregation of Israel had any part whatsoever in their making or in their donation, for they were a secret transmitted by the Almighty to Moses, and he wrote them in holiness, meaning Moses wrote them in holiness. The Urim and Tumim were thus of heavenly origin, and therefore they are referred to without any specification and with the definite article, in a similar usage to that which we have in the verse, quote, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden the cherubim. Okay. Now Moses took the inscription of the Urim and Tumim and placed them in the breastplate, of judgment after he had clothed Aaron with the ephod and the breastplate, as it is said. And he put the ephod upon him, and he girded him with the skillfully woven band of the ephod, and he placed the breastplate upon him, and in the breastplate he put the Urim and Thummim. For only after Aaron was already clothed with the ephod and the breastplate did Moses place the Urim and Thummim between the folds of the breastplate. Okay? Thus, the Urim and Thummim were the holy names of God, and it was by virtue of the power residing in these names that the letters inscribed upon the stones of the breastplate would light up before the eyes of the priest who inquired of the judgment. For example, when they inquired, "Who shall go up for us first against the Canaanites to fight against them?" the priest fixed his thoughts on those divine names which were in the Urim, and the letters forming the name of Judah lighted up before his eyes. And for the word Ya'aleh, which means he shall go up, the letter Yud lighted up from the word Levi, and the letter Ayin from Shimon, and the Lamed from Levi, and the He from Abraham, which was also written there according to the opinion of the rabbis. Okay. Now when the letters lighted up before the eyes of the priest, he did not yet know their arrangement. That is, how these letters were to be grouped together into words. For from the letters forming the words Judah, Yaleh, and Judah shall go up, it is possible to form the words Hoy Heid Aliyah, or Hey Al Yehuda, meaning Ramban is saying that from a series of letters that lit up, you can rearrange them to create numerous words. So how would he know what the right communication was? But then there were other sacred divine names, Ramban continues, in the fold of the breastplate, called the Tumim, literally perfection, through whose power the priest's heart was made perfect to understand the meaning of the letters which lighted up before his eyes. Thus, when he fixed his thoughts on the divine names in the Urim and the letters lighted up, he would then immediately turn and fix his thoughts on the divine names in the Tumim, while the letters of the Urim were still lit up before him, and then it came to his mind that they combined to form the words Yehuda Ya'aleh, which means Judah should go up first. That answered the question of who should go up first to war against the Canaanites. The knowledge of how to combine the letters that lit up in the breastplate into words is one level of the degrees of Ruach HaKodesh, which means a divine inspiration. It is lower than prophecy and higher than Bath Kol, which he does not describe what it is here, but which served in the second sanctuary after prophecy had ceased, and after the Urim and Thummim had ceased, just as our rabbis have mentioned. It is possible that after Moses placed the sacred names of the Urim and Thummim in the breastplate, they became known to the great sages of Israel, having been transmitted to them from Moses, together with the secrets of the Torah. Hence we find that David possessed an ephod, which was similar to the ephod of Moses. And together with it was a breastplate, similar to the holy breastplate in the tabernacle. It appears, however, that instead of being made of gold, blue, purple, and so on, it was made of linen, just as it says of Samuel, that he was a child girded with a linen ephod, and of Nob, the city of priests, it is said, 45 persons that did wear a linen ephod. They would clothe a priest who was of the sons of the prophets and inquire of him regarding certain events. And at times they were answered, just as Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra thought on this point. However, as far as that which he, Ibn Ezra, said, that if Rashi had seen the responsum of Rabbeinu Hai, he would not have explained, as he did, that the Urim and Thummim were inscriptions of the proper name of God. We now have already seen that the responsum and have considered it, and we know for certainly that it was Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra whose opinion shows that he did not grasp it. Okay. So just to call from this, the you see that this was something he talks about was divine. There was no parameters written in the Torah regarding this Urim and Thummim, which is interesting. Everything else had parameters, how to make it, what size it should be, what substance, gold, silver, should it be beaten out of one chunk, should it be assembled, but no mention of the Urim V'Tumim in terms of how do you make it. Right? So that's a point which Ramban felt was significant enough to write about here. All right. Let me just pause here. We said quite a bit. Let me just see if you have any questions or comments just before we go further. Let's start to, you know, approach the area in terms of what questions should we ask first.
Rabbi, one of the questions I have is that this seems like a really strange and convoluted process. I mean, there is prophecy where God speaks to people and tells them, you know, to do certain things. And yet here we have this sort of coded thing where I'm going to give you part of the message, but then you need a level of understanding that's a little bit below prophecy, but not quite, in order to decode it.
Right.
And I'm wondering, why have the priest do the interpretation at all? If there's a message to be gotten across, why not just give it? What's the whole purpose of this sort of slightly, this process that's subject to misinterpretation?
Right. Yeah, it's very unique, very, you said it seems convoluted.
Yeah.
Right. But we have to go step by step and to try to look at the hints that we have in order to see if we can arrive at some sort of an explanation. Again, we had a number of questions. Why do we have a king and a high priest? What is this division of labor, so to speak? It seems to be also from Rashi that this these names of God were only inquired of when they went to war. You didn't inquire of it when you had a question about how do I determine if this animal is kosher or not. Then there was nothing available to you except for your own intelligence, right? Or the king running the country in terms of what is he, should he make taxes on the people, so on and so forth. Rashi seems clear, and it seems from the cases that when was actually employed by the King David and so on, or what God tells Moses when he's about to die, that don't worry, that I'm going to set up Joshua. He'll stand before Eleazar, the priest, and he'll inquire about you. They're going out, meaning it seems to be about battle. So it seems to be some sort of relationship to battle. It's a very specific type of a case when you would use it. And why does it have to be part of the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest? And at that, why is it inserted in this breastplate? Very, very specific parameters in terms of how this works. But let's take a look now at some, a little bit more. If we look at the garment that it's placed in, so it has the names of the tribes, which was different than most of the other garments that the priest had. Rabbi Chait said one thing interesting, and I hope I'm recalling it accurately, but I believe this is what he said. He said that you see that the 12 tribes were inscribed in two locations. Six and six names were divided upon two different onyx stones on the shoulders of the priest. And then the names are written on the individual 12 stones on the breastplate. But they were suspended by chains. So what Rabbi Chait said was an interesting point, that the black stones represent the real sons of Jacob, but they are now dead. And black represents that, lifeless, a lifeless color. And they're on the shoulders of the priest. The 12 names of the tribes that are in color represent who? The descendants.
Descendants, who are still alive.
Exactly. The life, the colorful stones, the ones that that are alive today. But he said, you see that the ones that are alive today are on chains. They're being held up by the 12 tribes that were on the shoulders that had already passed, which means the merit. And my friend mentioned yesterday a good point. We say in the Shmona Esrei benedictions, the 18 benedictions, we say three times a day, we ask God to remember the kindness of the forefathers. And that's what the Rabbi Sheikh was saying, was that the Jews today are suspended on the merit of those original 12 tribes. Those original, how the nation first what came of the inception of the Jewish nation was by these 12 tribes and their merit, and they're living by the values of what they learned from Jacob and Isaac and Abraham. So you see that the living tribes are now, in terms of they recognize the perfection of the original real 12 individuals. And following that way in life now will earn them grace before God. I believe it's Rashi who talks about that the different garments of the priest acted as atonement for different aspects of the Jewish nation. But you see, it's an interesting concept in general, this the clothing of the high priest, that he goes before God sort of bearing the aspirations of the Jewish people in order to say, it's true that we sin, but we need atonement, and why should we get atonement from you, God? It is because of what, look at what I'm wearing. He comes in displaying the values of the Jewish people who accepted the Torah, and that Torah has the laws of this breastplate, which are suspended by gold chains to the original patriarchs, in order to say that we may sin, but we never do it as a mode of practice. We slip up, yes, but our real aspirations are represented by the high priest. And of course, the priestly family, the ones that were involved in temple worship, and they were the educators of the whole nation. So they were the ones that would give out knowledge to the people. They would educate the people. So as the emissary of all the people, he would come before God in the temple. He would come before God, so to speak, of course. God is not in the temple. But he would display that this is now, he'd be wearing the clothing. To what is clothing? Clothing is really how a person represents him, his values, how he wants to present himself. So a way to present yourself is by wearing certain clothing. I dress up when I go to a very formal affair. I want to demonstrate how much I value this. So that is exactly what the clothing is in terms of the high priest. He's demonstrating the value, but now as the emissary of all the people. So the first lesson we see is that the living Jews today, the colored stones, are really aspiring to identify with the patriarchs, meaning those 12 stones that were on the shoulders. The shoulders are where a person carries things. So we are being carried by that only because we aspire to those values. Okay? So that gives us some insight into what clothing is in terms of what these two very unique garments were. Now, we have to understand, well, it's very nice, but what does that have to do with going to battle and the names of God and lighting up the letters? Well, what is going on over here? It seems very, very odd. So let's understand what exactly battle is. If I asked you, how is that unique from other endeavors, and this is only where they inquired of God's name, well, what's the concept of inquiring of God over here but in no other area? What would you say?
Survival. I mean, if I go into battle and I do it wrong, my whole existence can be wiped out physically. If I'm in another area, like a philosophical area or a learning area, and I make a mistake, okay, I mean, I may be able to work my way back, but it's not going to immediately terminate my existence.
All right. So life, it's something which is dealing with life.
Right.
Right. Okay. And you see that the names of God are involved. Now, what can we say about the fact that God's name must be here?
Is it related to the idea that they should only be fighting the wars that Hashem wants them to fight, and so he has to be involved?
Well, it seems to me that it's recognizing that only through God can they be successful.
Right, that's exactly what the priest says to them. Don't worry, you're going to battle. When you see all the enemies and the horses and the chariots, and there are more people than you, let your heart not be soft, don't tremble, don't be afraid, because God will go before you, and he will save you. All right, so those are the exact words, actually, in Parsha Shoftim. That was Deuteronomy, let's just see, you got 20, right? Beginning of 20, I believe. Right. First couple of verses. Right. But interesting is doesn't say anything there about inquiring of this breastplate, right? But here it's trying to focus a bit on the fact that the priest plays a role. It's not the king. But doesn't, if I'm correct, it does not mention here anything about the breastplate. So what is a breastplate for? How does that play a role here? And what, again, God's names. So you're saying, Doug, it has to be only that the war is that God decides. Okay, I agree with that. And again, keep in mind, this is not used. This approach of inquiring of God is not used when a person is studying laws of Sabbath, and he doesn't come up, he can't figure out the answer, so he doesn't inquire of the breastplate to find out what the answer is. He's dealing with, like Rashi said on previously, that was Numbers 27:21. He says, when you inquire of him, meaning when you need to go out to war. So it's limited to battle. And like you're saying, Doug, survival.
Can I add a piece to that? Because if I'm figuring out what I should do, you know, on a daily basis or whatever, that's one thing. But if I go out to battle, I mean, battle in those days means I'm going to have to kill an enemy. And that enemy is part of God's creation.
Right.
And so, just as we talked about a blessing being before food, being an acknowledgement of the permit that I have to do that, I don't have any right to go out and destroy part of God's creation without his permission. And so maybe this is the permit for me to be able to go to war and battle and kill those people,
right.
Whereas otherwise I would not have that permission.
Right. Excellent. Exactly. And this really goes back to the primary distinction of two areas of knowledge that man can be involved in his life. There's knowledge of truths, meaning is this red, is this white? What is the law regarding, you know, an esrog, or how do I make tefillin, in terms of what are the truths? But then there's morality, which is what we're concerned with over here, battle, taking life. So like you said beautifully, Doug, that in this area, morality is something which is not in man's control. Man has the ability to perceive things intellectually and be 100% accurate. But in terms of morality, when is killing right or wrong? That can only come from God. That cannot be something which man decides. And that answers the question earlier we asked. What does this mean that they would inquire of this Urim V'Tumim, you know, the God's names, and then they would receive the Mishpat, the judgment, meaning the answer from the priest. The judgment means that justice is something which only God can determine. Right, so very well said, Doug. Exactly. This is really going back to a very basic fundamental of Judaism, or reality, we should say. And that is that in these two areas, there is one area that man can grasp himself, but then there's areas that are, like the Maimonides says, are of an authoritative character. And Maimonides speaks about this on when he talks about the difference between Moses perceived and what the Jews perceived at Sinai. And then the guide, he talks about the first two commands the Jews heard also. So it doesn't mean literally that the Jews heard them. According to Maimonides, the Jews only heard sounds throughout the entire, but he knew this, the Jews knew the sounds were of a intellectual design, an intellectual source, because there was a pattern to the sound. It was not a natural, like the blowing of the wind, which is a chaotic type of a structure, and there's no pattern in terms of the blowing of the wind or the falling of the leaves, but in terms of the sounds they heard at Sinai, they knew that this was now something which is organized sounds, that had to be an organizer behind it. But what Maimonides says over there in the Guide for Perplex is that, what does it mean that the Jews heard the first two commands just like Moses? It doesn't mean they heard it. It means that they grasped the concepts of knowing that God exists, which is the first of the Ten Commandments, and the rejection of idolatry, which is the second. See, the Jews knew that on the same level as Moses. And Maimonides says there that the prophet has no advantage in regard to these two concepts, because this is something which is the intelligence of a person can grasp. It's not of an authoritative character that you have to be told this. But in terms of morality, which you see the remainder of the commandments are, is it right to use God's name? Is it the Sabbath? Is that a proper idea or not? That you wouldn't know by studying the world. Honoring parents, and then all the laws between man and his fellow man. Murder and kidnapping and adultery and having bad desires or lying in court. All those things are of an authoritative character. We don't know whether that's right or wrong. That is something which has to be told to us. So that's exactly what's going on here. In the one area, when they go out to battle, and then, like you said, Doug, that life is now hanging in the balance, we have to determine these are God's creatures too. And this is not something which is in man's area. I mean, of course, if somebody's coming at you to kill you, you're allowed to defend yourself, but that's not what we're talking about. Here we're going out and we're going to initiate a battle. So now, in this case, we must be consulting with God. So that's what I mean, God's name. And throughout, the only thing we ever know about God, as Rabbi Chait explained so beautifully, is his name. We don't know what God is. We can't know. God says to Moses, because man cannot know me while he is alive. So that's what it means, the names were placed, because that is all we really know. I mean, for example, when we say the Shema Yisrael prayer, so we say, Hear, O Israel, God is our God, God is one. And then we say, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso Le'olam, blessed is the name of his kingdom forever. Meaning, all we could say in reference to God is the name. So we contemplate the name, and then God will now give a certain divine inspiration, because it must be through God alone that we determine the areas of life. Okay, unless, of course, we have something written in the Torah, which says if a person kills, he must be killed. So then we have regular cases where there are standards, and these are definitively arrived at because we know exactly what killing is, and the Torah can contain those cases. So then we can take the life without having to consult this Urim V'Tumim. But when you go to battle, so now you're initiating it. These people didn't kill yet, so the question is, what exactly are my rights over here? So this is now outside the framework, evidently, of the standard laws. So now there has to be something which comes into play and gives that authority. Okay? And that's, again, why it's judgment, because, again, what we're showing here is that, and this is similar to what we said regarding the crowns, if you remember, that we said the Jews got two crowns at Sinai. One was because they said, after hearing the Torah, they heard the ideas. And we're not talking about the Ten Commandments yet. They heard a good segment of the fundamentals of the Torah, and they said, we will do what we heard. And they also said, we will listen to what we have not yet heard, and we will do that as well. They demonstrated that man has a limitation in terms of his knowledge, but we see enough that we know that this divine system is perfect, and we accept limitation, and we will do even what we didn't hear yet. So you see this concept is reiterated over here, that this area that man just does not have knowledge of, and it's applied here in the breastplate in terms of morality. And that's why it's in the breastplate, because the breastplate has the names of human beings on it. It's not put into some other garment, but it's tied into the actual names and the letters of the 12 tribes lit up to indicate that this is a matter of a people. So it could be that that's why God had his names placed in the garment that had the individual names. You're now dealing with your life, the existing life of the Jews. That's the 12 tribes that were on the colored stones. They represented the living Jews. So battle is really concerning their life. But it's also, like you said, Doug, it's just dealing with life in general. So that is the one element that of the priest's garment that represented human life, that had the actual individual names of people. So it makes sense that that should be where the lesson comes. in terms of now this approach, whether we can take life or not. All right, let me pause here, see if there's any questions or comments.
Makes sense, Rabbi. Very amazing, too.
Yeah. Rabbi?
Yes, go.
I don't know if this is where you're going, but it seems now to me like a theme when you talk about the king has to consult with the high priest, and so it's recognizing that only God is complete. Man is not complete, and they need others in order to kind of complete a mission. They can't do it all by themselves, and so the king, it's also recognizing man's nature, that the emotions have a tendency to make us arrogant, in a sense. And if the king had ultimate power and everything, then it would be easy for him to be arrogant. But because he needs to consult with the high priest, he needs other people to make him complete, whereas only God is complete without anything else.
Right, exactly. That's what Tome means. I mean, the Urim and Tumim, meaning the words of the priest, even the priests are incomplete unless he consults with God on this. But the people also need the priest. You're right, on both levels. The people need the priest because they need to be educated. That was the whole role of the priestly class. And the priest himself needs to have a clarification of ideas, because man can't have ultimate knowledge. That's what you're saying?
Right.
Right. For sure, definitely. Right, and it seems to be that when you go to war, why was it that the anointed priest would then address the people? Because this was a matter they shouldn't think in terms of war, that this is now a practical matter. God is in all parts of life, so the priest who represented the education, the religious sphere of life, because the king is really in terms of practically running the country, right? There's practical matters. The existence of the priest seems to me that you should have, it's necessary to have a icon, a role model in terms of the religious life of the person. So that could be why there's both king and the priest, the high priest. He represents, he's the one that does the work in the temple. It's all religious matters. It's the religious sphere that he's working in. So even when they go to war, they should now realize, though, that it is not just a practical thing. We're going to fight, and whoever's stronger wins. No. The priest tells them finally that God will save you. It is God who's going before you, and God will save you. This has to be part of your religious life as well. So it's the priest, and it's not the king who addresses the people. Let me just read. Kuzar Rees has a question online. Did the Urim V'Tumim only work on the high priest who was worthy, like prophecy? Yeah, I believe so, that there was a case where somebody was not worthy, and it was not, it didn't have the functionality. I believe I read that over Shabbos. Somebody who's not worthy, who tries to force it, of course, will not work. Okay, let me see my notes. I want to make sure I took up all the points. And also, I think what the Ramban was pointing to, where he says, it doesn't say the ark, or make the table. These are just the first time they were introduced. But he says, make the Urim V'Tumim. So evidently, this is something I think he's trying to say, that it was communicated to Moses. Let me see here where he says... So he says that they were secret transmitted to Moses of heavenly origin, meaning the names of God. And therefore they were referred to with the word the. I think what he means there that Moses already had received the communication from God, so then God could say the Urim and the Tumim, meaning referring to that which he already taught Moses. But the fact that it was divine origin, I think, underlines our very point. And that is that it's outside the sphere of human understanding. Well, you said, Doug, you see? So by the fact that the Ramban is saying that these were divine origin, that they were not specified in the Torah, it's because it is outside of man's grasp of specification. That's the very point. So even as they're referred to, the actual referral to the Urim and Tumim in the Torah takes on the very nature of what they are. Since the Urim and Tumim is really something which demonstrates man's ignorance, he has no way to determine morality. That is only something which God can do. So to show you that it's not in man's sphere, it's not something which has parameters that can be described. You see the parallel?
Yes.
Isn't that interesting that the way God chose to communicate it was to that very communication embodies the essential idea of this. Since the essential idea of the Urim and Tumim means the same when it comes to, you know, other areas of knowledge, so that man can grasp. He can understand that there's a God. He can understand that the idolatry is foolish. When it comes to morality, that's not something which man can determine. Is it right to kill the baby when it's this old, that old, so on and so forth? Stem cell research, all these, that's why there's such a quandary about these areas of morality, because there is no absolute way to determine that. Morality is only determined by the one who created life, and that's God alone. Therefore, God communicates the fact that man has no real authority in this area by saying that there are no parameters in the Torah. And I think it's a beautiful parallel. It really backs up what we're saying.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Is there anything that you've come across that indicates once the Urim and Thummim were put in by Aaron that they could not be taken out again, or it was sealed in there or anything?
I don't know. Okay. I did not come across anything on that, yeah. But, I mean, I'm sure there's more to go through here. I mean, there's a Talmud that's brought down in Yuma. I don't think it mentions that there, though. It mentions a lot of what the Ramban mentioned. You can take a look at that. It talks about the order of the questions. It has to be asked a certain way. It even says over there that the names of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are on there because the 12 tribes were missing two letters. Even with all those names of the 12 tribes, you were still missing the Tzadi. So therefore, you needed Isaac, which is Yitzchak. And you also needed the letter Tes. So therefore, it also wrote the words Shivtei Kod, which means the tribes of God. But the word Shivtei then has the letter Tes, and that completes the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And Shira is asking and saying as follows. Someone was arguing with me, saying that according to Shemot 33, we can say the name of Yudkei Vavkei with vowels. And I said, no, we cannot. No, you're not allowed to pronounce God's name that way, and there's a reason. Rabbi Chaya explained that the fact that we read God's name as Yud, and then YHVW, I'm not sure how they do the transliteration in English, but it's Yud, and then a Hey, and then a Vav, and then another Hey, but we can't pronounce it that way. We pronounce it Ado, and then Noi, so we do not read it as it is written to demonstrate, again, that we cannot have an accurate understanding of God. So the fact that God's name is written one way, but we don't pronounce it, is a demonstration of our ignorance. Because if we can identify God by the very way it's written, it's as if we understand Him. So to demonstrate that we do not know what God is, we don't even read His name as it is written. Okay. I believe that the high priest only said it on Yom Kippur in the temple, I believe. But again, there's reasons why. And that was also the only day that the high priest was able to enter the Holy of Holies, which on every other day of the year you could not. And if you did go in, we just read in yesterday's Parsha, the two sons of Aaron were killed. Again, because that would demonstrate some sort of a closer proximity to God that didn't really exist. But they feel that they knew how to approach God. You can't, even if they had good intentions. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
So, if we're getting the idea across here that morality is only determined by God, and so they they have to essentially get God's permit because we have life and death matters going on here. What about the halakhic situations that start to get into the life and death arena? New gene therapy, fertility issues in medicine these days, or even just, you know, a criminal case where it's, maybe is a close halakhic decision about whether a person is to be executed. How are those things qualitatively different from the decision to go to war?
That's a good question. But it would seem like I was saying earlier, when a person, let's use an extreme case to answer your question. If somebody kills somebody, so that's a clear demonstration that he has lost his right to life. And that's something which is an absolute. Right? So the concept of, you know, what is not absolute seems to be what this is addressing. I would say also that if we were attacked, certainly we should respond. It seems to be here when we're going out to war, maybe when we're initiating war. So it's necessary. I agree with the question that we have to go further and see if we can distinguish between other areas of morality and, you know, initiating war per se.
I wonder if that's why then the Sanhedrin, as I understand it, was so very conservative with regard to execution. You know, the old statement, if one person gets executed in 70 years, it's considered a hanging court. Because they wanted to be sure that they were not stepping across the line.
What was it again? I'm not making clear.
I'm wondering if that's why it seems like, from what little I know, that the Sanhedrin was very conservative about executing people.
Yeah.
It was very, very rare, and that they would go out of their way to try to find a reason not to execute someone in a capital case. And I'm wondering if part of that may have been because they wanted to make sure they were not stepping across the line in terms of assuming, in terms of the morality question.
But then the case would be that they should never kill.
Yeah, except that they have a direct command. I mean, there's a direct command.
So then they can cross the line.
Right.
But I mean, I agree with the sense of what you're saying, is that, you know, life is something that you are very careful. They said that a court that would kill somebody even once in 70 years would be called a murderous court. Meaning even once in 70 years, if they kill somebody, that was too much.
Right.
The answer to Doug's question, though, would be more how important it is to preserve and keep intact the Jewish nation rather than the individual kind of morality decisions.
Uh-huh. You mean it's a national issue?
Right. And just is indicative of how important the Jewish nation is as a sort of light to all the other people.
Right.
So you'd be seeing it in a preservation of the nation issue as opposed to, does the nation have the right to go out and kill another nation?
Right.
I hear you. I don't know. I don't have a real clear answer to that. Other than what we said, that there are certain absolutes that if somebody kills, then you kill them. Why is there no absolute over here, though? I mean, there were cases where the Jews went to battle to wipe out the seven nations. There, I believe, you had actually God's directive at that point. All right, something to think about.
And then maybe you were going to continue on to it, but I guess the question is still then unanswered in my mind is, I see the purpose for it. Why go through the convoluted process of the stones lighting up and the interpretation by the priest, as opposed to just somehow giving the priest the information directly?
I don't know.
Okay.
I have a thought on that one, too.
Yeah, go ahead. Let me hear.
It seems like it's another pattern that you can see throughout the system, is that man is always required to use his intelligence. The only thing that man was given was the commandment, and even with that, we need to interpret the specifics of those commandments, and that we're never just given anything outright. We're required to always use our intelligence.
That's good. I thought Doug was asking about the lighting of the letters. That you'd be answering why he had to put his thought to the letters and arrange them properly.
Right.
You're not answering the why they had the specific form of the letters lighting up. Yeah.
Well, because God represents light, and that's the way that it's communicated through that.
I think. I don't see that clear. It seems loose.
Mm-hmm. I suppose an interesting question to ask would be, okay, if we were going to do it a different way, but we still had to have the priest use his intelligence?
Yeah.
What would the different way look like?
Yeah, I agree with what Cal's saying regarding using the intelligence, that's for sure. I mean, you do have corroboration, Cal, because you see that when Moses came down from the mountain, his face was beams of light coming from it. So light is used in terms of, there was a precedent for that.
Maybe the light represents the intelligence, and that intelligence was passed down through the nations, and that's why it's lit up through the various...
That could be, yeah. I mean, it's lighting up these people, the personalities.
Right, because it took all of them. It's, again, not just one.
All right, let's give it a thought. See if you can find some corroboration for what you're suggesting, too. Okay, any other questions or comments before we wrap it up?
You know, we've glossed over this so many times, so many years going through the Torah, and I've never gone through this section in such depth. And it's a reminder that there isn't a section in the Torah that doesn't have layers and layers and layers that you can go to.
Right, exactly. It's amazing, huh? I mean,
mm-hmm.
You start getting into something and then it just opens up.
Yeah.
You think it's just a few words, a few fleeting words in the Pusuk. No, there's a very important lesson there. God made sure that verse was in the Torah, too.
Yep, it's very true.
Cal, if you find any cover vibration during the week, let me know. I think what we'll do is write this up for the Jewish Times this coming week. So just to solidify it, you know, have something as a review and share it with others. So if you or Doug have, if you want to just jot down your contributions during today, and also if you find anything else, you know, please let me know.
Okay.
All right. Great class, Rabbi. Thank you.
Sure, sure.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, too. It's a teamwork, team effort. Questions and answers. All right, so we'll resume same time next week, 11:15. We're in daylight time, right? Eastern daylight time, right?
We are, but let's see. I think the UK switches over at the end of this month.
Uh-huh.
But they probably will be too, I guess, by next week.
All right, very good. All right, so we'll pick up next week. We'll see what we'll cover. And if you missed any part, we'll put this online soon. since we can hear from the beginning as well, for anybody who came late. And until then, a very good week to everybody.
And you too, Rabbi. Thanks so much.
Okay, take care, Doug, Cal, everybody else, Kuzuri, everybody. Take care. Have a good week.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll pick up next week. Bye-bye.